The second case on today's oral argument calendar is number A19-915, TMT Management Group LLC versus U.S. Bank and others. Counsel for appellant, Mr. White, you can approach and begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Kenneth White. I'm an attorney in Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent the appellants in this matter, TMT and Thomas Leiferman. Under Minnesota's antitrust statute, the statute makes a very explicit and broad declaration that a conspiracy to refuse to deal with another person to restrain trade is unlawful, period. The issue here is, given the role of this court as the common law interpreter of that statute and the common law limiter, if you will, of the hugely broad language of that statute, is whether that language prohibits the use of bribery to ensure that one purchaser secures the sale over any and all other purchasers in the universe.
So, Mr. White, but as I read our case law, it says that we, you know, look to federal case law, and obviously this provision is, you know, similar to the Section 1 of the Sherman Act, which, you know, when I look at those cases, they say exclusive dealing contracts are analyze under the rule of reason, and you define the product market, and then you look at the market power, and that didn't happen here. Why do we not use that analysis where this is a vertical arrangement?
Your Honor, I think the fundamental distinction between the system that you talked about and the system that is, or in the situation here, is that in the world in which this case arises, there is an interjection of anti-competitive activity, specific anti-competitive activity, that is the providing of a bribe, up to $1 million worth of a bribe. And that distorts the market and distorts the system to the extent that if you look at the overall federal case law, that I'd specifically refer the court, if you want to go to federal case law, to the Blue Tree Hotels case out of the Second Circuit that's cited in our brief, in which the Blue Tree Court, Blue Tree Hotel Court, collects cases out of five other circuits that say that commercial bribery is a violation. And so the
A per se violation.
And Minnesota is an even stronger per se state than the federal courts. Minnesota, through both Watt & Wan Telephone and this court's decision in Howe Transit, have recognized that Minnesota, in the way that it adopted its statute, has done so in a much broader sense of what is a per se violation. And so we get ourselves into a situation, Your Honors, where in this case, I believe it is a per se violation. And then you're down to three elements. And you do this three-element analysis. Is there standing? Is there an antitrust violation? And is there antitrust injury or damage? And if you look at this case, there's never been a challenge to standing. So we can skip past that element. We then get to the second element of, is there an antitrust violation. Commercial bribery is an antitrust violation, and I think this court should simply hold that to be true, period, end of discussion. What is the purpose behind the broad language of the statute? The broad language, the intent of the legislature, is to ensure that we have fair competition in Minnesota and that people do the right thing in their business practices.
Mr. White, doesn't that get back to, you know, the antitrust laws are to protect, you know, competition, not competitors? I mean, there are a lot of statutes. Ended up with, you know, convictions where commercial bribery comes into play. But that's the antitrust law as opposed to protect the marketplace. And
Yes, Your Honor, but and two responses to that. One, commercial bribery distorts the marketplace. There is no longer a market. There is simply a single buyer making a single purchase based on the bribe. But number two, again, if you go back to the federal case law says that where there is a per se violation, you do not have to prove broad commercial impact, you prove individual impact, impact to you as the prospective competitor in the marketplace.
But wasn't your client able to purchase a number of portfolios during this period of time, Mr. White? So how was it excluded from the market?
Well, Your Honor, the important element here is that that goes to the element that the Supreme Court adopted in Wanton 1 Television and that this court then went on to deal with, and that's this market foreclosure notion. I would submit to the court that the market foreclosure notion in a circumstance of commercial bribery simply does not make sense. That if you're dealing with commercial bribery, that distorts the market, and that eliminates the market for that particular product. And this court in Alpine Air and in other similar cases has never looked at what is the relevant market. In Alpine Air, there were other places to go get air purifiers. I go down to Menards and you can buy a dozen different brands of air purifiers. This court did not say, well, you don't have an antitrust violation in Alpine Air because you don't have you haven't eliminated all the potential purchasers for air purifiers. Instead, this court looked at what was the impact by the conduct at that point on the marketplace.
And how would the impact on the market be different between the two scenarios? One where U.S. Bank enters into an exclusive contract with UCR without bribery, and on the other hand, U.S. Bank enters into an exclusive contract with UCR with bribery. I mean, how do they have a different effect on the marketplace?
The difference in the marketplace is, Your Honor, that TMT and anyone else who wants to get involved in purchasing U.S. Bank DDA portfolios can then compete with UCR. Can say, all right, UCR is willing to give you 3 cents on the dollar for your portfolios. We're willing to give you 4. If U.S. Bank makes the decision UCR is a more stable purchaser or is more nationwide or for whatever legitimate business reasons, such as those that existed in the Wanton 1 TV and Howe Transport cases, for legitimate business reasons, we're going to go with your competitor. No one has anything to complain about. What happens here, though, is that UCR interjected a bribe and used the bribe to distort the marketplace and to, in fact, eliminate the marketplace. And so U.S. Bank was left purchasing or allowing UCR to make these purchases and purchases at a substantially less amount, a smaller dollar figure, than TMT offered. In one case, it was, I think, 3.86 versus a nickel. And when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, that gets to be real money. The issue the significant issue here is that the interjection of that commercial bribe into the marketplace creates the distortion. If you even need to get to the existence of a distortion given the federal case law that says a per se violation is eliminates that whole discussion of is there a marketplace impact, you deal just with the individual nature of the impact. And so I think you can get there in two different ways, Your Honor, either by recognizing the distortion in the marketplace or by recognizing that it becomes irrelevant under the per se violation rules.
So are you arguing that really this is an issue, this commercial bribery argument should be analyzed differently than our Supreme Court has analyzed the antitrust claims in Wanton 1 and others? I mean, are you asking us to ignore our Supreme Court authority or extend it because it hasn't been decided before?
Your Honor, I'm not asking you
because
to.
Because obviously we can't do the former.
Yeah, you cannot do the former, and I would never ask this court to overrule the folks upstairs.
They don't take lightly. They're going to take that lightly.
They would be unhappy with all of us. So, no, I'm not asking this court or suggesting to this court that Wanton Television and How Transport need to be overruled. What I am suggesting is that in Wanton Television and How Transport, this court, when at the Court of Appeals level, and then when it got to the Supreme Court, when it dealt with the issue, was dealing with a situation of, as far as the record reveals in the opinions, was dealing with a situation of pure commercial competition, where the parties had the freedom to contract to do what they wanted to do, as long as there wasn't this interjection of inappropriate conduct. And neither the Supreme Court nor this court has ever dealt with a situation of commercial bribery, where that is interjected into the competitive marketplace for a particular product. And I take you back to the broad language of the statute, which says it is a violation to do what happened in this case under the statute. And so now we're in a situation of, is this court going to create an exception that says, but the legislature didn't really mean to go that far as the Supreme Court did in Wanton Television, and we're going to allow the commercial bribery to be interjected into the marketplace in Minnesota.
So both in your brief and here today, you've concentrated on the antitrust allegations. We haven't talked about the court's finding that a principal of your client committed fraud on the court by fabricating an email. We haven't talked about the promissory estoppel arguments. Do you agree that your strongest arguments here are the arguments related to the antitrust as opposed to the court's findings on those other issues?
I would not agree, Your Honor, that the court can dismiss or ignore the promissory estoppel argument. I think, though, that that's pretty clearly laid out in the briefs, and we're really just taking existing law and applying it. And that's the stuff that this court does on a very regular basis. And the antitrust question is one where this court is stepping into the role of interpreting the legislative intent and the language of the statute. And so I think that's why the primary emphasis here today. I do not dispute that my client created the email. I would note that the email, though, related to that 2011 effort to create a forward flow contract and had nothing to do with the 2013 lunch meeting, which is the promissory estoppel claim, and that there are a number of less restrictive alternatives that the district court could have applied that would have had significant impacts on the promissory estoppel claim, and that in effect what the district court...
Well, except the oral comments that, or agreements, alleged agreements that the court restricted, went directly to the formation of a $200 million contract. Seems to me the court would be pretty cautious about that with admitted violations by your principals and your client that they'd already fabricated a document to try to create an oral contract or show the existence of one. That seems really troublesome from the district court's perspective. I don't know what lesser restrictive alternative, especially in light of the request to just dismiss your claims as a sanction, which the court rejected, the court could have applied after having that type of fraud committed on the court that's admitted here.
Well, Your Honor, I think the problem with that analysis is the same. It takes you down the same route that the district court went. And the district court, at page A39, if I remember correctly, of the of our addendum, in its opinion, addressed exactly the same point that I think you're making, Judge Flory, which is, why would we ever believe anything that comes out of your client's mouth after this egregious conduct? That's a jury function. Every one of us has had a kid who said, no, I didn't take the cookie out of the cookie jar. We know darn well the kid took the cookie out of the cookie jar. We still believe our kid the next time that something comes up. And yes, this is dramatically more significant than that. But that puts us in a position where curative instruction would be perfectly appropriate to deal with the issue and to tell the jury, one of the principals of TMT committed a fraud on the court, and that's a really awful thing to do. And you could have achieved the same remedy. And let the jury decide, all right, we don't believe him there, but we're going to believe him there, because there's all this other. And recognize the district court didn't just exclude the testimony from Mr. Leiferman. The district court excluded all testimony from anybody, whether written or oral. And so that's, I think, where the abuse of discretion comes in and where the lesser standard needs to, or a lesser sanction needs to be applied. I see my time is up. I would ask the court to reverse and remand.
Hold on, Mr. White. I think Jessen may have a question. Well, I have a question.
Okay.
You mentioned Blue Tree. Respondents argue in their responsive brief that Blue Tree is, I'm looking now at page 36 of their brief in the footnote, they say Blue Tree was not an antitrust case. And the court said, we need not and do not decide whether these allegations would qualify as an antitrust injury. And so I was looking forward to your reply brief to see how you would, that seems like, that seems like it gives me a significantly different understanding of Blue Tree. But anyway, so what is your rebuttal argument to that?
Your Honor, Blue Tree takes you into the weeds of federal jurisprudence. The Blue Tree decision is dealing with a Robinson-Patman violation, which is a different section of the statute. However, under federal antitrust law, under the Sherman Act, there is no individual cause of action. There is no individual cause of action under Robertson-Patman. There is under the Clayton Act. And so the discussion in Blue Tree is how we apply the Clayton Act standards to a violation of Robertson-Patman when we are dealing with a violation, or what is the standard for an individual cause of action. And so that's why the distinction that the defendant, that U.S. Bank tries to draw, ultimately doesn't matter here, because you're dealing with what is the standard that the courts are going to apply to allow a Clayton Act violation to create the individual cause of action that doesn't exist under either of the two federal statutes.
All of these statutes you've mentioned are within the realm of antitrust law, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
But so, okay, well, maybe I'll wait for your opposing counsel to explain further on that.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may approach and begin.
May it please the court. My name is Brooks Poley, and I represent respondents U.S. Bank and Jacob Van Brandwijk. I'd like to concisely address three issues this morning. First, the district court's reasonable exercise of its broad discretion in ordering non-monetary sanctions against appellant TMT. Second, the district court's proper dismissal of TMT's refusal to deal claim under Minnesota's antitrust statute. And finally, the district court's correct dismissal of TMT's promissory estoppel claim. Let me begin with the sanctions issue, and it is important to appreciate, I believe, the breathtaking nature of the misconduct carried out by TMT and one of its principals, Tom Leiferman. For purposes of background briefly, faced with the impending failure of what had been clearly its flagship claim in this lawsuit, a $60 million contract claim, TMT sought to outright fabricate evidence and, in fact, manufactured a new document by sitting down at its laptop computer, which purported to confirm the existence of a multi-million dollar, multi-year agreement between itself and U.S. Bank. The response from TMT, when challenged about this remarkable new but slightly suspicious document, was to double down. TMT denied what it had done. It stonewalled both the court and U.S. Bank for months, and it thereafter questioned U.S. Bank and challenged U.S. Bank's integrity for having the temerity for dispute the authenticity of this document. In fact, only now in this forum, for the first time, has TMT finally admitted its forgery, and yet it still attempts to whitewash the the magnitude of its deception, characterizing it as, at page 2 of its reply brief, a mere litigation error, which it immediately recognized. This was not an error. It was a calculated, intentional fraud designed to subvert the entire litigation process in pursuit of a multimillion dollar judgment, and TMT's so-called immediate recognition of its error took 12 months and occurred only after it was caught absolutely red-handed. The legal questions with respect to the sanctions questions are narrow. As is recognized by both sides in this matter, the governing standard of review is abuse of discretion, which provides that the district court's judgment should be upheld unless it is clear that no reasonable person would agree with the district court's assessment in this matter. Here, the district court did not abuse its considerable discretion, as it cannot be said that no reasonable person could agree with what Judge Simonet did. The district court's sanction, in fact, was both measured and eminently reasonable given the circumstances. Given the gravity of TMT's enormous misconduct, U.S. Bank urged the dismissal of the entire case outright, a sanction that Minnesota Supreme Court had expressly authorized in its Seagate decision. However, despite the legal support for this significant sanction, the district court denied our request and instead fashioned a lesser sanction that squarely zeroed in on TMT's precise fraudulent conduct. Specifically, because TMT had shown its willingness to fabricate critical evidence of purported oral agreements between itself and U.S. Bank, Judge Simonet reasonably precluded it from doing so again, ruling that evidence or purported oral statements by U.S. Bank representatives would not be permitted.
Mr. Pauly, I don't have any questions for you on this issue, but I do have questions about the antitrust issue.
I'm happy to address them, Your Honor. I'll certainly turn to the antitrust matter if you'd prefer
that. I appreciate
that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let me then immediately jump to antitrust.
And as a preliminary matter for that, do the sanctions issues play into to your antitrust arguments at all?
They do not.
All right. So go ahead with your antitrust argument.
Thank you. Members of the court, this case was never remotely an antitrust action. Instead, it has always at its core been a basic contract fraud case that TMT sought to spice up with exotic theories, originally RICO and antitrust, among others, that held out the threat of treble damages and attorney's fee awards. However, not only were these exotic theories previously dismissed at the federal court level, but TMT now admits that its sole remaining state antitrust theory, a refusal to deal claim, does not meet Minnesota law. I'd like to, for purposes of context, recognize the classic refusal to deal case, which is from the United States Supreme Court in the Clores Inc. versus Broadway Hail Store. It's a 1959 decision from the Supreme Court. And as this court has already recognized, there is a relatively small amount of antitrust precedent within the state of Minnesota. So some of the cases that have been recited, as is this one, is a federal decision.
I just want to ask you about one specific case, given our limited time.
Yes.
I mean, you heard probably my questions to Mr. White, kind of the way I think of antitrust law, where we're dealing with kind of a vertical agreement and exclusive dealing contracts that would be under the rule of reason analysis, as opposed and thinking that would also probably apply here. But then I'm looking at, you know, our statute and then the Huff case. And here's the question, the part of that decision that does give me some pause. And it says this section, that's Minnesota Statute 325D.53,
yes,
does not require the restraint of trade to be between competitors, and therefore a vertical non-price restraint on trade arguably could be per se illegal under the statute, and then notes, under federal law, vertical non-price restraints are never illegal per se. That language could lead me to say that maybe we should be reading our statute more broadly than the analogous, you know, Section 1 of the Sherman Act. Could you address that for me?
Certainly. The Huff Court gets it exactly right. It is
Do you agree with that analysis?
I do agree with that analysis, and I'll tell you why. The Minnesota statute in this instance, which is 325D.53, subdivision 1.3, which is the refusal to deal claim, is one area where there is not perfect symmetry between the federal antitrust jurisprudence and Minnesota's. As the Huff decision notes, a vertical claim for refusal to deal or a group boycott would be evaluated under the rule of reason. Under that statute in Minnesota, it is still considered a per se violation. And all of the analysis that Huff undertakes...
I mean, you just said group boycott. That's not what happened here.
A group boycott and a refusal to deal are considered the same thing. It's two different ways of stating the same violation.
Go ahead.
So in Minnesota, the refusal to deal, which is their specific claim here, is evaluated under the per se standard. That is correct. But the analysis gets put upside down on its head in this case as a result of the briefing from the appellant is as follows. One of their suggestions here is that because this is a per se analysis, a per se case, we can simply skip through all of the other analysis that the court has done. There's only two decisions in Minnesota that address this statute in the refusal to deal context. One is the Watt and Wan case from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1980. The other is a 1991 decision in the Huff matter. And what those courts did is what is critical here, and it is in fact why they acknowledge that under application of existing Minnesota law, their case fails. Because those courts said there are two requirements, and this is what must be done first. Where they've gotten upside down is they first say it's per se, so we can skip through the requirements. You don't get to the per se factor. Per se is not relevant until you first determine that a violation has occurred in the first instance. And what Watt and Wan and Huff tell us is how do we decide if in the first case a violation has occurred, whether a refusal to deal has occurred. If you get there, if you check the box, yes, we have a refusal to deal, then you apply the per se standard, and you need not go into a balancing of the pro-competitive versus the anti-competitive results of that.
So then we don't worry about, well, what does the market look like?
For purposes of those cases with one, and I'll come back to the market piece of that analysis, because there are two parts. Number one, did this alleged agreement specifically target one entity? In this instance, they concede it did not. Secondly, were they foreclosed from the market? They concede they were not. So under both Watt and Wan and Huff, there is not a refusal to deal in the first instance. That much is clear. And in fact, they concede that because they say at page 4 of the reply brief, if we apply Minnesota law, we lose. They say that plain and simple. What they do instead of honoring the Minnesota precedent, which requires dismissal of their case, as Judge Simonet did, they suggest that instead what this court should do is rewrite Minnesota law. And what they principally focus on is this notion that there was bribery. Now, let's be very clear. That's a salacious fact. But it has no relevance to an antitrust claim in this instance. None. Because of several things. What they've done is they've offered you a whole bunch of law, none of it's refusal to deal, none of it, not one piece, not one scintilla evidence stands for the proposition that if you have a bribery, any kind of an allegation of bribery, it can somehow convert a case that is otherwise not an antitrust violation, not a refusal to deal, into one, because there was some underlying bribery.
Is there any authority saying otherwise?
Yes.
In which cases are you
in fact
thinking of?
You may recall in the brief from appellant, there was a three-page block quote. It was from the World Wrestling decision from the Southern District of New York. And in fact, that case was evaluated amidst the backdrop of allegations of bribery. And the court specifically observed that case and dismissed that case, notwithstanding the allegations of bribery. That was a fact that was not recognized in the discussion of that.
And did that court reason that the manner in which the contract was entered into is irrelevant? You know, in other words, the means of bribery was completely irrelevant, or was it decided on other grounds? Could you tell us more about the reasoning there?
Certainly. There was a lot going on in that decision, but one of the things that I can tell you is that one of the allegations that was presented by the plaintiff in that case was that bribery was an element, a fact that supported the notion of an antitrust violation. The court rejected that. And in fact, what the court said was while the bribes may have been unfair competition, that alone does not make them an antitrust violation. That's exactly the proposition here. Because of the fact that there can be bribery in a case with an antitrust allegation, and that allegation and that case can in fact be an antitrust violation in fact, or it might not be. But the existence of bribery doesn't make it one way or another. You have to first look at the structural elements to make that determination. And in this case, under this statute, the refusal to deal statute here, the courts have been very clear about what is required. What is required is targeting, and what is required is market foreclosure in this refusal to deal. Their thesis, in fact, is something very different. Their thesis is, if someone posits the existence of a bribery or other illicit underlying conduct, we skip all of the analysis. We simply immediately conclude that an antitrust violation has been established. That's not the law in Minnesota. And what they're doing is asking this court to change the law.
Does the record reflect how many companies were bidding on to acquire these portfolios from U.S. Bank, or how many were interested, or?
It does. I can tell you the alleged conspiracy that they set forth originally ran from 2007 until middle of 2011, although that changed over time in their testimony, but that was the core of their allegation. In fact, when they said that there was a conspiracy to exclude, to refuse a deal with their client, TMT didn't even exist yet. They weren't formed until 2008. But during this time frame, when there were multiple DDA portfolios that were sold, there were bidding processes throughout that time frame, and the number of bidders changed over time, depending, I suppose, on the metrics of the portfolio and how interested people were in bidding. For example,
But can you tell us the number or approximate number or range of?
I can, and I just my only I don't want to misrepresent, but for example, in 2011, there was a portfolio in June. I believe there were approximately four or five bids that were received from interested parties. In 2000, that was a relatively consistent number, sometimes slightly higher, sometimes slightly lower. But if in terms of a mean, it would be four or five interested parties.
Thank you.
But the law is clear. You asked about other cases. I would also recommend the court to the Stanley Nelson decision at 235 F sup 393 from the District of Idaho. That's a case in which the court, there was another bribery allegation. In fact, in that case, the bribery allegation that an influential employee had steered business, and the court, notwithstanding the allegation of bribery, dismissed the case because it failed to meet one of the structural requirements of the antitrust claim that had been pled.
But then doesn't that get us back to where we started, that Indeed. There's this divergence between federal antitrust law and the Minnesota statute?
In this one area, I would say that there's a divergence insofar as for a refusal to deal claim, which is the only one that is present here under subsection 1.3, in Minnesota, it is still under the statute. It is a per se violation. Under federal law, that would be a rule of reason violation. However, there are two cases and only two in Minnesota that evaluate this statute in Minnesota under Minnesota law. And what they tell us is plainly that they don't meet that standard.
But neither of them had this commercial bribery aspect.
They didn't. But what we then have is while we do look to federal laws, because Minnesota courts tell us we should look to federal jurisprudence on antitrust, and what it does do for us is, because they don't have any authority for this notion of bribery, it's just a thesis that they've tossed out. So when we do look to federal law, what we see is that the federal courts considered it in antitrust cases and have rejected it as an independent factor that can convert something to an antitrust violation without the standard being otherwise met. It is not met here. My time is up.
Yeah, you may sum up if you wish.
Thank you. As noted, we believe what is telling in the antitrust violation is, number one, that they simply have conceded that application of Minnesota law as it exists from the Supreme Court and this court requires affirmance of dismissal. The sanctions in this matter were eminently reasonable given the abuse of discretion standard, and the promissory estoppel claim falls both for the independent reason that the court found that no clear promise had been established, and the sanction takes away any evidence to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Poley. Mr. White, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Let me address two principal issues. First, there is a suggestion that the federal antitrust law does not allow for a claim where there is the universe or all potential purchasers being involved in the goal. The target needs to be to a specific individual as opposed to universally. The U.S. Supreme Court expressly rejected that notion in the Kiefer Stewart case, which is cited in our brief. In Kiefer Stewart, you had two liquor wholesalers who conspired together to eliminate competition at the retail level by saying, if you do not fix your prices at the same level that we do, that we direct, we're not going to sell to you. Well, one company said, we're not going along with that game, sorry, and they got excluded from the marketplace and brought a claim. The Supreme Court allowed that claim to go forward. Similarly here, U.S. Bank has said to the world, unless you pay us a bribe, we're not going to deal with you. Well, UCR paid the bribe. TMT didn't know that it needed to. There's one extraordinarily cynical federal court, and I forget which one it was, that actually went so far as to say, this isn't an antitrust problem because you could have just provided a bigger bribe. And the marketplace would then be even more distorted, presumably. And so it is, I think, inaccurate at best to suggest that that the Minnesota antitrust statute requires an individualized focus on the particular facts of the particular case and recognize the guidance that we have from the U.S. Supreme Court. In dealing with antitrust violations, you look at the particular facts of this particular case and you come to a conclusion about whether or not the reach of the statute should go that far. And in Minnesota, targeting and market foreclosure were ways that the Supreme Court used to limit the extent of this broad language of the statute in a circumstance where two innocent businesses entered into a contract that happened to exclude somebody else. Those contracts get entered into every day. They will continue to get entered into every day. I mean, lawyers enter into them every day. We represent one side, not the other. That's an exclusive contract. I can't represent U.S. Bank in this case because I represent TMT. That's an exclusive contract. It's not an antitrust violation. The second issue, which I think is even more important, is if we go back to worldwide wrestling and what the U.S. Supreme Court has told us about the basis for the worldwide wrestling dismissal of the case. Worldwide wrestling, the court dismissed the case because it found a lack of antitrust injury, that there was no antitrust injury proven in that case. So what does the U.S. Supreme Court tell us about? In fact, the court went so far as to say there's not even an allegation of antitrust injury. So what does the U.S. Supreme Court tell us about, there it went, antitrust injury? And this is cited in our briefs, Your Honor, in our brief at page 16, carrying over into page 17. A plaintiff must prove the existence of antitrust injury, which is to say injury of the type the antitrust laws were intended to prevent and that flows from that which makes defendants' acts unlawful. Well, I didn't hear anything from the bank suggesting that commercial bribery is lawful. So I think we can set that side of the analysis apart. There is no argument that any...
I'm sorry. Am I correct in assuming that the wrestling opinion cited and applied Blue Tree?
The wrestling opinion, yeah. Well,
I mean, it's a New York Federal District Court, New York case.
I don't
Blue
remember
the Second Circuit case.
I don't remember the dates of the two decisions.
Wrestling came later.
Okay, then I would suggest no. I don't think Blue Tree is cited anywhere in the wrestling case, but it goes through the same three-step analysis that the court goes through in Blue Tree. Under this Clayton Act shot at or basis for individual claims. But what I think is significant in this case is that the antitrust injury as defined by the U.S. Supreme Court exists. That is, there is no question that TMT lost the opportunity, in fact, lost the high bid on at least one contract that we know of, because of the antitrust violation, the anti-competitive act. And if you apply that to the broad language of the Minnesota statute, the reach of that statute should include commercial bribery. Otherwise, I would suggest to this court that you have effectively made commercial bribery the new standard for contracting in Minnesota, a step which the legislature would surely not countenance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. White. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. counsel in the third case may come forward and get ready.